ghosts.
Hello, Ghostbusters.
They're real.
You do? You have?
They're here. Ghostbusters.
Hey, anybody see a ghost?
They catch the ghost that won't stay dead. They're armed. They're dangerous.
Try to imagine all life as you know it stopping instantaneously and every molecule in your body exploding at the speed of light.
All right, that's bad. Okay, all right, important safety tip. Thanks, Egon.
They're professionals.
Oh,
I'm the chairman of the largest paranormal removal company in America.
You see it?
They're all that stand between you and the end of the world.
The city is headed for a disaster of biblical proportion.
Real wrath of God type stuff.
Exactly.
Fire and brimstone coming down from the sky.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together. Mass hysteria.
Your girlfriend lives in the corner penthouse of Spook Central.
You want this body?
Is this a trick question?
Got your stick?
Hold!
Beat him up!
Smoke him!
Make him hard!
Ready!
Ghostbusters. Starring Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Sigourney Weaver, Harold Ramis, Rick Moranis. Coming to save the world.
Who you gonna call?
Ghostbusters.
We came, we saw, we kicked it.
Hello and welcome back to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Gelly. And joining me this week to talk about the classic, the one, the only, Ghostbusters, is our pal from the Council of Geeks podcast, Nathaniel Wayne. Nathaniel, welcome back to the show.
I'm always happy to be here and absolutely thrilled to be talking about this movie.
Well, I didn't really have any choice, as some of you may recall. Way back on episode 3 of this show, I got a very threatening email from Nathaniel demanding that he be the guest on any Ghostbusters episode. And he threatened me with physical violence. And I normally don't want to give in to terroristic threats like that. But as you see, I did. So,
well, I believe my exact words were, I will cut you.
Yeah. Well, okay. It's a terroristic threat in my book, Nathaniel.
Well,
I don't know what to tell
you. Yeah, but it could have been a paper cut for all you knew. It wouldn't have been, but I'm just saying.
Good to know. So we're very happy to have you here because obviously this is one of your favorite movies. This is one of my favorite movies.
This is my favorite movie, full stop.
Period. Oh, wow.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Very good. Before we get into the sort of history, our personal histories of Ghostbusters, I'm going to give everybody just a very brief history of this sort of production. This was obviously a movie that sprang forth from the brain, the fertile brain of Dan Aykroyd, among the millions of the other concepts that he had going around. And of course, he originally wrote it for him and his pal, John Belushi. And then John Belushi passed away in March of 1982. And there, I believe it laid fallow for a while. And then at some point he returned to it. And then he brought it over to his pal, Harold Ramis, which, of course, they knew each other from Second City in the days of Saturday Night Live. And Harold Ramis recognized immediately that it was virtually – and now Ivan Reitman, they brought it together, it was unshootable. Because it featured like universe-spanning Ghostbusters, and there was like a whole set of – there was like teams of Ghostbusters. I mean, this would have been like a $1 billion movie to shoot. So it was Reitman and Ramis that really got it down, boiled it down to this essential story, and that's when they roped in their pal Bill Murray, filling in for the sort of John Belushi part. And they got together, and they left a lot of room for improvising, even though this was a very heavy special effects-laden film. And they very improbably captured lightning in a bottle. This thing was pretty much, they knew that they had a hit from the beginning. They knew what they had when they shot it. There's some other things we'll get into about how it all got made and the very nice sort of sacrifice Dan Aykroyd made for his pal Bill Murray, but we'll get to that in a moment. But that was Ghostbusters, and it was released in June of 1984. It was a massive hit. It was the biggest hit of the year, the biggest grossing comedy of all time, outgrossing John Belushi's Animal House, ironically enough. And there it stayed, became this beloved thing between the cartoon and then Ghostbusters 2, and now, of course, the remake, which is just a couple of days away from when you're hearing this. So, Nathaniel, you say this is your all-time favorite movie?
This is the one, yes.
Now, why is that?
Oh, boy.
Other than it's really funny.
it is really funny, but I effectively grew up on this movie. Now, I didn't see this when this first came out in theaters because I was two, but I do have a very clear memory of seeing it in the theater, which still does show my age a bit because back in the 80s.
Oh, be quiet.
Look, just because you're ancient doesn't mean I'm not allowed to feel a little bit my age. Anyways, because back in the 80s, you know, there weren't three new movies out every weekend. So it was not an uncommon thing for successful movies to get second, third, fourth runs in theaters if they had nothing else to show. So I do have very clear memories of seeing it in the theater. I was probably five, if I were to guess. And I have a very clear memory of my mother leaning over to me just as the movie started, saying, "Now, this might be a little scary. If you want to leave, just tell me." I'm like, "Yeah, okay." And I just sat there transfixed for the entire thing. And I grew up on Ghostbusters. I grew up on this movie. I grew up on the cartoon. I'm not going to say I grew up on the second one, even though I was still really young when it came out, because I didn't like it even initially, and I've come to like the second one much less as time has gone on. But there's almost nothing that doesn't work about this movie. And about the only thing that I would say doesn't work is a issue of time having passed certain tropes by and not an issue with the movie itself. This is a movie that I put in a very special little box and what I consider to be a perfect movie. And when I say that, I don't mean the single greatest movie ever made, even though it's my favorite. I mean, it's a movie that I would not change anything.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Not a single moment. Not even the effects. I wouldn't even update the effects on this, because I actually think that they were made at the perfect time, because the seams were just visible enough that they had to make the ghost a little bit blurry, which I actually think was to their benefit. Because if you compare, say, Slimer in the original, and you look at him, and even in Ghostbusters 2, and he doesn't look right. And the reason is he's too sharp. He's not blurry enough, and you can really see that it's a puppet.
Yeah, the effects here look terrific. I think they completely hold up. They don't all look aged.
From top to bottom, every effect still holds up. There's like maybe one or two bits of stop motion with some of the long distance shots of the terror dogs, but like that's it. And the other thing, I think part of the reason this has become my favorite movie is it had things that hooked me at a very young age, obviously, which was basically, you know, camaraderie and friendship and blasting monsters with lasers. But as I grew older, I came to really appreciate how funny this thing is, how many layers it works on, how well thought out it is, how lived in the world is. And, you know, as I sort of grew in an appreciation of film as an art, I keep coming back to this and just realizing this, not only is this as much fun as I always thought it is, it really is a great movie, just assembled, put together on every level. I feel like I find another reason to love it every time I watch it. And I've probably seen it over 60 times.
Yeah, I would agree that there's nothing that you would change in this movie. Nothing with the effects, none of the lines. I mean, I mentioned earlier about that for a movie that is very special effects heavy, Ivan Reitman knew that he had to leave certain scenes, you know, open that could allow for improvisation. And of course, you know, when you're leaving open for improvisation, that's you're playing to the strengths of your characters, of your actors. Bill Murray and Aykroyd and Ramis, all of whom had a long history together. It's only Ernie Hudson that's sort of the odd man out in terms of, you know, his relationship with these actors. And of course, that was originally supposed to be Eddie Murphy. That's another one of those things where I would have been really curious to see what this movie would have been like with Eddie Murphy, but I think it would have thrown it off its axis if Eddie Murphy had come in at some point and been in this movie.
I'm not sure it would have thrown off its axis for the movie itself. I think it could have gone either way. I do think that if it had been Eddie Murphy, we would have run the risk of this ultimately becoming a footnote in Eddie Murphy's career, at least, you know, when he went on to explode much bigger than most of these other guys did post 84. So, I, you know, just for that reason alone, I can't, and I mean, I really love Ernie Hudson. I think he's in many ways the unsung MVP of this movie anyways, but that's a whole other thing I could get into.
Well, he's a nice contrast to the three of them, and I don't mean that in any other sense than just he's the one who's not buying into this nonsense. I mean, Murray doesn't buy into it either, but Murray is one of the gang. It's Zeddemore Winston who comes in and is just like, what is going on with these guys? You know, I mean, and I think he's a good audience surrogate a little. I mean, even in the scene in the jail cell where, you know, the three Ghostbusters are willing to go down with each other, and it's Winston that's like, guys, you guys are crazy. I mean, this is a little – I mean, I think a lot of people would have that reaction.
Oh, yeah. And he's got the, like, I got to get my own lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And so let me ask you this, because, again, I've thought about this a lot, and I've got my own prepared answer when it comes back to me. But who is your favorite Ghostbuster?
Oh, Venkman. It's Bill Murray. I loved Bill Murray – before Ghostbusters, and I loved Bill Murray. After Ghostbusters, I've loved virtually everything Bill Murray has done. But, I mean, he is just the perfect – I saw this movie when I was 13. I saw it in the theater. Yes, I am ancient. And he is the perfect – Bill Murray as a actor and then as a character in this film, Venkman, he is the perfect person to fall in love with when you're 13 because he's a wise ass. He's a permanent wise ass, and when you're that age, you look up to people like that. And he's just – he's so – I mean, right from the very beginning, the opening scene where he's torturing that kid and putting the moves on the blonde girl with all the fake tarot cards – not tarot cards, but the fake mind-reading cards.
Yep.
I mean, you completely get who he is immediately. I love when he smacks Ray in the head when he's trying to – you know, he's right in the middle of something, Ray. I mean, he's truly – you know, he's just the perfect – person for a kid that age to become your hero, because he's and at the end he gets to be heroic, you know, he turns and he gets to be the big hero along with the other Ghostbusters. It's like he's brave, but and he gets the girl, and not just any girl, Sigourney Weaver from Pete 6, who was tremendous in this movie. And
that could have been such a throwaway part. Dana Barrett could have been they could have just hired any pretty face, and it could have been a complete drag on the film, but she's so good in that part.
Yeah, as a side note, it frustrates me that those two have not done more movies together when they clearly like each other quite a bit.
Yeah.
I wish that, just put them in other movies. You don't have to do Ghostbusters 3, 4, 5. Just put Bill Murray and Sigourney Weaver in a movie together. They clearly like one another, but for some reason that's never happened.
Yeah, they are quite good together. And I will say the other thing is that their chemistry together sort of takes the curse off the one thing, and I kind of alluded to it before, that I think dates the film in a not great way, which actually is that opening scene in Venkman. Now, from a character perspective and the overall narrative, it's a perfect opening scene because it tells you everything you need to know about the guy. Unfortunately, at this point in time, you know, the 80s, it read as, you know, that sort of lovable, incorrigible scamp who'll do anything to try and land the girl. Nowadays, watching it, when you stop and think...
Oh, he's completely sexually harassing Dana Barrett.
Well, no, not even before Dana Barrett. That girl in that opening scene, he's her professor. So actually, I think the movie does a lot to take the curse off that by A, getting him fired so he's not around students anymore, and B, the fact that Sigourney Weaver completely sees through his shtick and doesn't
like
buy it for
almost
a second. Yeah. So the fact that, you know, he is like this, but none of those tricks work on her helps take the curse of it because, you know, like I said, that opening scene at the time just read incorrigible, oh, those crazy guys, because that was the time. Nowadays, it can read a bit creepy, but I can it doesn't become problematic for me even now because of the way his relationship with Dana works. I mean, the entire basis of their relationship is she doesn't buy his shtick, but still thinks he's a good guy.
Yeah, she does put up with a lot when he comes into the apartment and he so relentlessly hits on her.
Yeah.
And he really is creepy in a lot of ways. And there's other things about this movie that if you choose to look at them from a certain angle, you're kind of like, wait a minute, this movie is really kind of saying some funny things in terms of the whole thing with the EPA and that old stuff, but we can get into that. But I kind of feel similarly to this the way I'm a big fan of the TV series MASH. It's my favorite show. And it's like, you know, people are constantly hitting on Major Houlihan on that show. And in any other context, that would be incredibly sexist and inappropriate. But because the actress who played that character, Loretta Swit, was so strong as a Sigourney Weaver, you don't fear for them for one second. And of course, Sigourney Weaver went on to become the ultimate sort of badass in movies, you know. So, but in terms of when I, again, when I saw it when I was 13, you know, I looked at this movie as sort of the end result of the years together that Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd had on Saturday Night Live. I watched that show when I was a kid, when I was much too young to understand the jokes, but my parents let me watch it anyway. And, you know, seeing these guys in a movie together, I mean, I followed all of them. I followed Aykroyd and Belushi and the Blues Brothers, and I even saw Dr. Detroit from Pete's Sakes. But when, you know, I saw Stripes, you know, and Tootsie with Bill Murray. But when these guys were all in a movie together, it felt like a thesis, your master's thesis. It felt like that. It felt like this was the ultimate extension of the Saturday Night Live brand of humor writ large. And the fact that it was such a massive success, and you're right, this was pretty much the biggest Aykroyd is ever going to be after this. And he's been trying to recapture that ever since to middling effect. Bill Murray went on to a whole different thing. I mean, he realized he sort of didn't really want to be a big star after this and pocketed his money and went to live in France for a couple of years and then just sort of goofed around and did things that were interesting to him because he made enough money off Ghostbusters. But that's I can't ever separate Ghostbusters from Saturday Night Live. In my mind, it's just the extension of those years together. And we're jumping ahead a little bit. I mean, the one scene that I think actually is sort of, I don't know, touching in a very serious way is at the very end when they are about to cross the streams. And Bill Murray turns to Venkman and he says, "See you on the other side, Ray."
Ray just smiles.
Ray just smiles, yeah.
Yeah, it's nice working with you, Dr. Venkman.
Yeah, that felt like a message to the audience that you're familiar with these people. You beyond the characters, you've seen these guys together for years on television. They're huge stars, and now here they are. That scene always gets me a little because it feels like there's just a little more to it than just these characters. It's all the history of Saturday Night Live wrapped up in these performers.
Well, see, now it's funny because I think it's funny that you mentioned that because, you know, obviously due to my age, I wasn't watching these guys on Saturday Night Live. I hadn't seen anything else. I don't think any of them had done before I saw this. But that vibe still comes through very strongly, and because this had I actually brought it up when we talked about Masters of the Universe, where that felt like a continuation of something that was already going on. This has that same feel, partly because of the way the story is structured, because at the time the movie opens, even though they haven't seen a ghost before, obviously Ray and Egon already believe in ghosts, and Bill's part of that group, and they've been friends for a while, so you feel that history. And that's in story structure, but the chemistry between all of them, you feel that these people have known each other and they've been friends for a long time. And it gives it that feeling of history that I always love but is so rare to find. And it's funny, it had never really occurred to me that the reason this movie has it is because they all were friends and knew each other for a while before. But it, I always love that vibe when you can find it, and this movie has it in spades.
Yeah, and the friendship extends, as I mentioned earlier, to off-screen, is that the way this movie kind of originally got made sort of in the end was they wrote this script, and apparently everyone in Hollywood wanted it. Every studio wanted it. They knew it was going to be a hit. It smelled like a hit. They had the right group. They just figured this was a perfect thing, and so everybody wanted Ghostbusters. But Aykroyd controlled it, and he wasn't ready to hand it over to anybody just yet. They weren't making a deal. So apparently at some point Aykroyd calls Murray and says, you know, okay, Bill, we got to start getting schedules put together. Are you going to be available from this date to this date? And Murray was ready to do it, but he was distracted by the fact that he was trying to get his version of The Razor's Edge off the ground, which was, of course, a very uncommercial project because it was a drama. Bill Murray had not done a drama really to that point. So, and he was having trouble getting anybody to finance it. And he was sort of put Aykroyd off a little and said, I'll do it, but I really, right now, I'm just focusing on Razor's Edge. And Aykroyd flat out told Bill Murray, you tell any studio that if they take Razor's Edge, they can have Ghostbusters. And the minute Columbia Pictures heard that deal, they took it because they knew they'd make more money off Ghostbusters than what they'd lose on Razor's Edge. And I thought that has always touched me deeply that Aykroyd would make that sacrifice, not a sacrifice, but make that deal for his friend. You know, and apparently literally Bill Murray went off and shot Razor's Edge and came back like on a Friday and started shooting Ghostbusters on a Saturday. It was that tight. And I've always thought that was beautiful. And I, you know, we'll cover that on the show later on, The Razor's Edge. It's my favorite book, and I really enjoy that movie that Murray did. But I just love the idea that Ghostbusters paved the way for The Razor's Edge. I just think that's wonderful. And it shows a generosity of spirit in Dan Aykroyd that, you know, maybe Bill Murray didn't quite return when it came time to do Ghostbusters 3, you know, or whatever. But yeah, I feel like you can almost see how relaxed Murray is. Like, you know, I mean, he had to have felt relaxed from shooting this movie because of all he's hanging around his friends. He's got great lines. And he's got this major achievement under his belt. You know, he went and got Razor's Edge shot and done, and he knew that. And now he could just sort of, like, have fun and run around with these crazy, you know, costumes on and these, you know, the proton packs and all that. And that's something else about this movie has more quotable lines than virtually any other comedy I can think of. I mean, just, you know, this movie is now 30 years old and people still know all the lines from it. And from either it's Egon's or Aykroyd's or Venkman's or Ray's. I mean, it's just amazingly quotable. And that's remarkable when you think that at least a good portion of it was made up on the spot.
Yeah. Now, since you mentioned that, I'm going to tell you my favorite line. Then I'm going to backtrack to my favorite Ghostbuster. So my favorite line in the movie, and even from when I was a kid, and I think when I was a little kid, it had to do with the delivery. And as I came to appreciate what the line meant more, I love it all the more. But it's Winston's line, Ray, when someone asks you if you're a god, you say yes. And actually, Winston is my favorite Ghostbuster at this point.
Really?
Well, here's the thing. Wow. My favorite Ghostbuster has changed over time. When I was a little kid, my favorite Ghostbuster was Ray. And I think that was because I gravitated towards the joy that he had. Because he had a very childlike sort of awe, and he was –
Does his poll still work?
It. Yeah. And so he – I think as a little kid, I gravitated to just how childlike he was, and I related to that, and I liked him best. As I hit my teens, and I sort of hit the age that you would have first seen it, you old man, I Venkman became my favorite because I came to appreciate sort of that snarkiness and that – sort of easygoing cynicism where, you know, he doesn't necessarily think the world sucks, but he's prepared to make fun of it all the same.
But the kids love it.
Yeah. At this point, though, there's a lot about Winston that I love. I love the fact that he's just answering a want ad. He's just there to do the job. He doesn't even really believe this stuff. He certainly doesn't understand it. But he does the job as well as the rest of them do it. He is prepared, you know, like we said, he doesn't necessarily want to go to jail for these guys, but when it comes to strapping on that pack and being prepared to face death with the rest of them, he's prepared to do that just as readily as the rest of them. I love the philosophical edge that he brings to things when he has the conversation about basically the Bible and God with Ray. And you can see how put off Ray is and how uncomfortable Ray is by this conversation. But Winston's just kicking back like, yeah, I think this is probably what's going on. And I've just felt this pull towards Winston as I've gotten older and Ernie Hudson's performance. And I think at some point I came to realize just because he shows up later doesn't mean he can't be my favorite.
Sure.
And I don't know when I realized that, but when I realized that, I was like, yeah. And because I always love that he effectively has the last line of the movie too, which he's up there covered in marshmallows. I love this town. And to me, that just feels so right that it – ends with him is like, that was a good day at the office.
It's remarkably generous of the filmmakers to give him the last line of the movie. I mean, it really is. I mean, he's not – I mean, there's scenes later on, of course, but in turn – and you hear Lewis Tully, the great Rick Moranis, have a line. But effectively the movie is over, though, with Winston.
Yeah, but the credits are rolling. The movie's done after that line.
Yeah. They bring him up to the level of, he's a full-on Ghostbuster, you know. And like I said, and Ernie Hudson is – terrific in this movie. Is very fun. I mean, just being able to hold himself on the screen against these three guys was remarkable. And we really haven't talked anything much about Harold Ramis just yet, which obviously deserves the late great Harold Ramis. I mean, he is tremendous in this movie. He was
poured into that part. I mean, I've seen him in other movies, and it's not like he doesn't have range as an actor, but that was so perfectly tailored to how he looked, how he performed, how he sounded. It's like I can't think of Harold Ramis and not think Egon Spengler.
Yeah. I mean, the first time we see him and when he talks about the, you know, I stopped you from drilling a hole in your head. And he's like, that would have worked if you hadn't stopped me. You know, you're like, okay, he's the smart guy, but he's actually not that smart, obviously, if he's doing things like that.
He's smart, but he knows he's smart, and he's maybe he's a little too cocky in what he's doing.
Yeah. That's absolutely true. The containment field that they built. I mean, this is something Dan Aykroyd loves. Dan Aykroyd loves complicated mechanics and sort of like weaponry and tubes running in. And this feels like it. This is all him with all the stuff of the ghost containment system. I mean, that stuff feels like it comes right out of his brain. That whole idea. And it seems completely plausible. The mechanics of it, that you put the trap in, you load. I mean, you even get a whole instructional thing about how to do this, how to load a ghost into the machine.
There's a wonderful logic to the tech, because if you think about it, it's like, okay, if there's ghosts, that means something about us stays around after we die. Now, a lazy screenwriter would have just given the Ghostbusters something that blasted into oblivion. But if you stop and think about it, that's an existential nightmare, first of all, because you're obliterating a soul in theory. But if you think about it logically at all, okay, well, if there's something about us that persists after we die, then could you ever really destroy that? Probably not. Okay, so we have to trap it. So we use this thing to basically lasso it. We put it in a trap. We move it somewhere else. It all flows. It has a terrific internal logic to the thing.
And the idea that you can only hold so many ghosts in a particular area, like that's, yep, again, that's an idea of ghost keeping that nobody had really done before. The idea that there is some sort of physical space that it's limited. You can only serve so many of them. I mean, it would be the size of a Twinkie 30 feet long. You know, I mean, it's
the Twinkie. That's all great stuff. You know, it's funny. I just thought of this because you talked about how generous Dan Aykroyd was with Bill Murray and The Razor's Edge. Now, I can't necessarily vouch for the validity of this story because I've heard a couple of different versions, but I'm going to tell the version I like. Do you know how Rick Moranis ended up playing Lewis Tully?
Well, it was originally supposed to be John Candy.
It was.
And John Candy wanted to do some weird German accent thing, and they were just like, that's not what we want. And he basically didn't want to do it if he couldn't do that or something. I thought that's what
I heard. Well, the version that I heard, which is the one I like to believe, was that Candy, it wasn't that he was insisting on doing a weird accent, it's that he said he couldn't wrap his head around the character. He couldn't find a way to feel comfortable doing this part. So he was trying things like a German accent, like these other things, and nothing was clicking. And he knew it wasn't working. And when he saw the writing on the wall that he wasn't going to keep this part because he wasn't figuring it out, he said, hey, do you guys know Rick Moranis? I think he would nail this.
Hmm.
Again, don't know if it's true, but I like to believe that it is.
I'd always heard that John Candy was an exceedingly nice man, so that seems completely plausible.
Yeah,
they would have done that. And it's funny to think about Candy in that part, because it's not that Candy couldn't play a Nebbish, because he certainly did, but I think, like, again, it would have been a different feeling watching Dana Barrett be mean or sort of, you know, I don't know. I don't think John Candy is as easily dismissed as Rick Moranis would be.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't necessarily come across as mean when she's trying to avoid Lewis when it's Rick Moranis, because Rick Moranis is so tiny and unassuming and kind of odd. Like, you can't get angry at someone who's just trying to be like, look, I'm just trying to get to my apartment with somebody like him.
He played a workout at double speed. He got a greater workout in half the time.
Anybody want to play Parcheesi?
Oh. Yeah, I mean, and the funny voice he gives it, like that kind of okay, like that slow, you know, it's like it is Rick Moranis is the perfect example of a supporting character.
Yeah,
I do not want to, and this we're not going to get into Ghostbusters 2 really, because maybe we'll do a whole other show on that movie, maybe not. But it's like, I think part of the thing that went that goes wrong with a lot of sequels of other, you know, of famous films, is they give you more of the side characters, and that's not always a good thing. See Jaws 4, you know, but I mean, it's like, I don't want to see more of Lewis Tully. What they gave us in the first movie is exactly the right amount. You know?
Well, of course, one of the many egregious sins of Ghostbusters 2 was pairing Lewis Tully romantically with Janine Melnitz. What?
Yeah, I didn't understand that myself.
That made no sense, which of course brings up Janine. Annie Potts is so good in that part. Because
the quintessential New Yorker.
The quintessential New Yorker. She's unfazed by so much, and she's just this, this secretary who just brushes this stuff off. Yet at the same time, she can have her moments of being concerned, and when it comes to Egon, for getting excited when they finally got a call. We got one! Or one of my favorite lines, when the cop's at the door, she just looks at him, dropping off or picking up.
We said Bellevue doesn't want him. We figure you guys could do something with him. I love that idea that the Ghostbusters are that firmly established in the New York sort of situation that they're like, well, we got this nuts guy. We don't do anything with him. Let's bring him to the Ghostbusters. Sure, why not?
Yeah. You know? Yeah. They deal with weird stuff. This guy's weird.
Yeah. They're like a community center or something like that. Yeah. 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 I mean, Ginny, yeah, she is. Annie Potts is really, really funny in this movie. I mean, I've quit better jobs than this. I mean, she's got, you know, I mean, Prince is dead, of course. Oh, that's fascinating. You know, I mean, she's like, again, perfectly cast supporting part.
Every part in this is perfectly cast. And then, of course, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention Dickless.
Of course, Walter Peck, played by
William Atherton.
William Atherton, the great William Atherton. Whose apparently life was ruined after this movie.
I know. He said people would holler, "Hey, Dickless," at him, like when he was walking down the street, after, like for decades after this movie came out. I think it just had to be a matter of he had to start to get old enough and not be rocking the beard anymore that people finally stopped doing that.
He's a little heavier now. I think people probably don't as easily recognize him. Plus, now, what do you think of the movies? You know, when you think about it, you hate Peck. You hate him because he's just a giant dick. At the same time, he's not wrong.
He's not wrong. And here's the thing, because some people have decided, I think, to make a mountain out of a molehill in terms of the whole EPA thing and be like, well, is the movie really anti-government and anti-legislation? I think people are reading too much into that. The way that I sort of, you know, square that circle is he's not wrong, but he's the only member of the EPA we see. So you could argue on the one hand, well, he's therefore representative of the whole thing. I personally view him as somebody – he's a petty tyrant. He's somebody who has this little niche of power, and he's going to force everybody who falls into under his tiny umbrella of authority to dance to his tune, damn it, and you'll do it the way I say you do it.
And he hates Venkman right from the get-go.
Oh, yeah, immediately. So I never – even as I got older and I, you know, read people's treatises on, you know, thinking too much about this whole – I still don't read it as an anti-government or anti-regulation or anti-EPA thing. I read it as an anti-being a jerk about your job thing more than anything else because – again, you're right. He's not wrong, but he is such a jerk right off the bat that Venkman blowing him off – to me, still reads more as getting rid of a jerk as opposed to I hate the EPA.
Right, because, I mean, eventually we see that the government, you know, the mayor ends up being a very sympathetic character. I mean, the cops end up on the Ghostbusters side. I mean, I think you're right. This movie is not some sort of like libertarian, you know, fantasy or anything. It really is that he is a particular a-hole.
Yeah,
and, of course, William Atherton was great at that.
Oh, he was perfect at it. And everyone else with authority in the movie turns on him. You know, right. The mayor just looks at him, points, get him out of here,
yeah.
Yeah, and nobody objects. Nobody comes to his defense. It's like, we don't need that guy.
I love the story that, you know, in his final scene where he gets doused with all the Stay Puft marshmallow that apparently they showed him the giant pot they mm-hmm. were going to dump him with. And he was like, is that safe? And then, because that looks like a lot. And he's like, oh, no, that's fine. And he insisted on being tested or something, and they dumped it on something else, and it crushed whatever it was that they dumped it on. And they were like,
yep.
See? Yeah, you probably would have broken several bones if we had done that.
Yeah, I think they ended up dumping on it like a third of how much they'd intended to.
And I love that after he gets hit with it, you can hear him on the soundtrack, like, screaming. Like,
yes.
like yelling into the heavens.
It's completely unintelligible, but it's...
I always assumed that the marshmallow was hot because it was after they just blew it up. So I always assumed that not only was he dumped with it, that it was very warm, almost scalding. That was how I took that. And, you know, again, in terms of the movie's pacing, it saves the best for last with the Stay Puft Marshmallow because that is – this movie's – all. I mean, in a movie full of visual invention and great tricks against Slimer, which was, of course, a sort of backhanded tribute to John Belushi and all the other characters in it and the proton packs, the movie saves the Stay Puft Marshmallow for the end, which is the ultimate great reveal. Seeing it just behind the buildings and a little bit there, and then the full reveal of it, it is one of the great – I remember seeing, again, I saw in the theater, and people screamed with laughter because it was just so absurd. And yet, the Ghostbusters have to take it seriously. I'm terrified beyond the capacity for rational thought, Ray.
Yeah, that's what I love about this movie. And again, it's something that I think Ghostbusters 2 did wrong because it flipped it. What this movie does very goofy things, but takes it seriously. I mean, you'll have somebody like, you know, like Venkman tossing a line off at it, but they have to take it seriously. The second movie, unfortunately, did more serious things, like put a baby in jeopardy, but treat it like it was goofy. And the reversal doesn't work. Doing something goofy but treating it serious can work, and here it works wonderfully. They kind of did the opposite with Ghostbusters 2, and again, one of many reasons why that movie doesn't work.
I hear people screaming now into their iPhones. I want to defend Ghostbusters 2.
Here's the one thing, and I know Ghostbusters 2 has its fans, and that's fine. You know what? Like what you like. You're wrong, but go ahead and like what you like.
Wow.
Here is, in my mind, the indefensible sin of Ghostbusters 2, regardless of what you like about it. It hit the reset button.
Yes.
For absolutely no good reason. The team has to get back together again.
Yep.
He has to woo Dana again. Why? Why are we retreading the same beats that we already did? That, regardless of whatever merit any other aspect of the film has, that was so pointless, and it renders at least about 40 minutes worth of that movie completely redundant and repetitive when you take the first one into account.
Yeah, I don't want to go too far down this road, but I remember many years ago when Bill Murray was on The Daily Show, the Craig Kilborn version, and they used to do a bit where they would ask five questions. And one of the questions, they said, name five funny Bill Murray movies. And he said, oh, you know, Meatballs, Stripes, you know, Tootsie, blah, blah, blah. And then he very pointedly said, the first Ghostbusters. He was very specific about that. So he's like, okay, even Bill was a little disappointed with that. But yeah, I agree with that. I hate the idea that all the movies, all the characters' success in the first film is basically invalidated in that second film. But let's stick to the first one, because like I said, I'm as much as I enjoy the second film, I can just leave it out of my mind when I think of this first one, because I enjoy this one so well, and it works so well. And of course, they got lucky with one of the catchiest theme songs of all time.
Oh, God, yeah. Which they got sued over, but because they ripped off Huey Lewis. I forget which song that
I
was.
I Want a New Drug, supposedly. I don't hear it. I don't understand how those songs sound alike. But
I thought it was Heart of Rock and Roll.
Oh, maybe. I don't hear it in either one.
Well, you know, just in case anyone doesn't know the story, they supposedly had actually asked Huey Lewis to do it because they wanted his style of song. He said no. They did a song that sounded enough like stuff that he does that he successfully sued them for it. And then he would later go on to do music for Back to the Future with Power of Love, saying, well, you know what? If they're going to rip me off anyway, I'll take the paycheck.
Makes sense.
But yeah, that song is it's so weird. I couldn't tell you why this song works here when almost every other song for a movie that references the title of the movie sucks. I'm not sure why it works here. I mean, it does. Maybe it's something about the sort of – it's not trying to be clever. It's just the song literally is an advertisement for the movie. It's just saying flat out, who are you going to call? Ghostbusters. It's the tagline of the movie in song. And maybe it's sort of the brazenness of that that makes it work. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, they open the movie with it, you know,
yeah.
I mean, with the logo. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of corny and cheesy, and that is not the style of humor for Marion Eckwood, but yet it just seems to work perfectly. I mean, I remember the video that features them all and a bunch of cameos, and man, that thing played on MTV in constant rotation. I mean, that was just such a – I mean, except they really did get lucky with – and I think there's something about that little – I don't know anything about music, but they're like the dan, and it feels like Ghosts to me. It feels like electrical energy. It feels kind of like the movie to me. It has that tone to it.
That's actually my favorite part of that song, and I came to love that part of the song more because of the cartoon. because that would be the music that they would usually play during the climax of any given episode of the cartoon, where they'd, you know, finally be taking down whoever the villain of that episode was, and the music would be din, din, din. So, you know, that's my favorite part of that song anyways. But yeah, it's energetic and it's fun and it's celebratory, and yeah, it just works.
You mentioned the cartoon, and that's something I always thought was sort of interesting about this movie, is that, you know, following the cartoon and following Ghostbusters 2, which was much more family friendly, you know, Ghostbusters kind of became synonymous with family entertainment. And mm-hmm. you watch this movie is really not meant for that. This movie has a ghost blowjob scene, for Pete's sakes.
It does, which was a gag I did not get for a very long time. But, you know, it does actually create an interesting conundrum, because right now my daughter loves the Ghostbusters cartoon, and I am trying to figure out at what point I'm going to allow her to see the movie, because she's not old enough yet. But because I have the complete box set of the cartoon. So she's been watching it, and she loves it, and, you know, she loves Slimer, she loves the monsters, she, you know, she loves all the stuff about it. But I'm like, I can't show you this movie yet.
Yeah, yeah. Daddy, why is the zipper going? Don't worry about it. Don't worry. Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
Daddy, what does Mother Puss Bucket mean? Yeah. No.
That sounded so dirty when I was 13. I was like, oh my, can he say that? It's like, he's really not really saying anything.
Yeah, it doesn't mean anything, but it sounds awful.
Horrible, yeah. I mean, this movie has a real grit to it, and that has to partly come from the fact that it was shot on location in New York. It's a very New York movie. You know, I mean, like, Bill Murray apparently was sort of a folk hero when he was shooting this, you know. I mean, people yelled at him and like, hey, Bill, like, I mean, even back then he was, I mean, then that was before he became the household name that he became because of this movie. But I mean, that's part of it. It has a real grit to it that I think helps underscore the ridiculousness of the comedy. I mean, you know, the little details of like when they go to the hotel and the you know, the guy's like, what, he's some sort of cosmonaut? And then they blow up the poor maid's card. I mean, it's like all these little gritty details of the New York life. They run into a lot of New York people. They run into Ray goes on the Joe Franklin show. I mean, have you met it? You know, have you seen Elvis?
They've got Larry King.
Yeah, Larry King is in it. I mean, you know, they talk about them going to a discotheque. You heard Casey Kasem do that. I mean, it's got a real sense of like a real place. And that is something that, and we're going to get into this near the end of the show about the remake that troubles me, is that the remake is set in New York, but it's shot in Boston. And so to me, it's like, well, then you're really not going to get New York if you're shooting it in Boston, because that's not New York. If you want to set the movie in Boston and shoot it in Boston, great.
I think that would have made a ton more sense. Yeah. I mean, like, if you're going to differentiate it. Set it in a different city. That's fine.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
This movie like has said, very we'll specific architecture. Into that. Yeah, I mean, Ghostbusters has very specific – I mean, there you see the Dakota and all – I mean, all these very famous buildings. It works really well as a nice little travelogue of this city, you know. I mean, the Ghostbusters building is around and you can go visit it and stuff like that. I mean, it's
– And
it's,
I have.
Oh, really?
Yes, I have.
Well, let's hear about
you,
that.
You can – I was in college – and me and a bunch of my friends went down – well, one of my friends was actually from New York, so we all crashed at her place. So we went down to New York to see something on Broadway. We went and saw – Noises Off is what we saw, which is a great play, a mediocre movie, but a great play. And I was not the only Ghostbusters fanatic in the group. There was one other. So between the two of us, we were like, we need to go to the firehouse. And you go there and it's just the exterior. Because the interior of the firehouse was a set.
Right.
But the exterior is, except for the sign, it's the same building. And we went and we actually talked to a firefighter who was around, not for the first movie, but he was around when they shot the second one. Mm-hmm. Where apparently there was more than a little bit of tension. They had to, like, drag him away from the basketball court to get him to do takes. And he was clashing with the director, Ivan Reitman, basically because he didn't want to work. Not necessarily in a I hate this movie, I think it sucks way, but just in a he was at a point where he just didn't want to work in general. Mm-hmm. No idea how valid that is or how much it's been embedded, because I have a feeling this guy probably tells this story to everyone who comes in because it's the Ghostbuster house. So it could very easily have gotten embellished over time. So but that that is what he told me. But it was a very cool thing to get to walk up to the Ghostbusters firehouse and just look at it and go, oh yeah, that's it. That's awesome.
Yeah, during one of our trips in art school, we went to the New York Public Library and stood out there outside because we just wanted to be able to go, you know, be able to the New York Public Library.
I could never walk by that building without looking at the lions and hearing the music in my head. Dun, dun.
Yeah. And this movie does have one of the great Bafo openings of all time.
Oh,
That pre-credit sequence with the librarian, you know, are you Alice? Menstruating right now. Yeah, I mean, Alice is great. I mean, it again, we talk about that for a horror comedy, it does take the horror very seriously. You know, I mean, the zombie cabbie guy always creeped me out. Even at 13,
he's
I was like,
wonderfully creepy. And God, how creepy is that scene where the hands pop out of Dana's chair, grab her, and she is dragged into the kitchen?
That is straight up horror. That is a straight up
terror
horror
dog.
Scene. Yep.
Because the terror dogs are that's classic 80s demonic design that they've got going on with that thing. It's awesome. And it is. It's legitimately scary.
Yeah. And the idea that like the building is a conductor for supernatural energy. You know, again, these are ideas that Aykroyd really likes to spring forth out of his brain. And it's like, who thinks of this stuff? You know, I mean, it's just that's incredibly imaginative. I mean, it really does take the world of ghosts seemingly very serious. There were books, again, the Tobin, you know, Spade's catalog, Tobin Spirit Guide. I mean, these are real books that you can consult. I mean, it really does put you in this sort of real world, which, again, is a perfect counterpoint to Venkman's just complete, you know, this is all a bunch of crap. This is all, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, I mean, he can only have that way so far because, I mean, he sees a ghost early on in the movie. You know, I mean, he knows it's all real. Even he's... You know, I mean, like the stuff when he goes to visit Dana Barry's apartment, I always feel like he's making half of that up. Like when he's playing the piano keys and he's like, oh, they hate this. I'm like, he's just BSing. That's
the piano keys
true.
He's absolutely making up. I have a feeling he doesn't really know how to use that piece of equipment, or at least he doesn't know how it works. Like he was probably shown by Ray and Egon what to do with it. He probably could not explain what the heck it does. So when she asks, what is that thing you're doing? And he just says, it's technical. That's him covering for the fact that he doesn't know what it does or how it works. Not because he's an idiot, but because he's lazy.
Yeah. And he said, and they said those two, Sigourney and Bill Murray. And that's something you can't plan on. You know, some actors have chemistry and some don't. And they just had perfect chemistry. And they did a play together right after 9/11 as a benefit for firefighters. And it's like, that's one of those things where, why don't you know, I'm repeating myself, but put these two in a movie again together. You know,
I
don't understand why you can't.
He's still funny. She still looks amazing.
She's wonderful. I love Sigourney Weaver. It's just she's great. She's absolutely great, you know. And she. I saw them all on Oprah in 1989 pushing Ghostbusters, and they had a really great rapport on stage together. They were tremendous, and so they really put together an amazing group of actors, all of whom are really, you know, operating on all thrusters at this point. And it really all just comes together perfectly. And like you said at the beginning, like there is nothing about this I would change. There's so many lines that give me sort of comfort when I think about them because I just laugh internally because I'm like, oh, they're just, you know, I mean, the idea that like, you know, they go in and they're rattling off the prices just off the top of their heads. You know, it's going to be,
yep.
Okay, big five for the containment. And then we're running a special on.
Oh, God, you know, that was one of a number of scenes that I did not have a full appreciation of until maybe about 10 years ago because I grew up on the VHS, which was, you know, it was
pan
and scan.
Yeah.
So Egon was cut out of that shot. So I didn't know that Egon was like holding up fingers for how much money he should be saying until I got the DVD and I finally saw it in widescreen.
Yep. That scene gets ruined by pan and scan. Yeah.
You want to know what was the weirdest pan and scan thing? And I don't think they did this on every VHS version, but when they're in the elevator going up,
right.
You know, when they're looking for Slimer, you know, that shot, widescreen, they're all in the shot and then they're, you know, Ray's in the middle and then you've got Egon and Peter in the background and they're taking up the whole frame. What they did on the VHS version that I had was rather than crop any one of them out, they squished the whole thing together so they just looked stretched.
Huh.
And weirdly tall. And that always struck me as odd even as a kid, but I never thought too much about it. I was just like, oh, I don't know why that elevator shot's so weird until I finally saw it, you know, as an adult and saw it in widescreen and went, duh, they squished the thing together.
That's interesting, because, yeah, they would have killed the joke if you had cut one of them out, because it is perfect when he switched me on and they flip.
Yeah,
the sound, the wonderful, you know, Foley sounds of that, just the way that thing comes on, you can almost feel like you hear the flames crackling on the inside of it, that whoosh sound, and the two of them,
the sounds in this thing are iconic. The sounds of the proton packs, of the noises the containment unit makes when they put something in it, the noise of switching the thing on, it's great stuff.
I forget who did the I mean, I know it's Richard Edlund did the special effects. I don't know who did the sound stuff, but yeah, I mean, these were all guys working really, again, at the top of their game, and you don't necessarily see that kind of stuff, that level of detail, for a comedy. But I mean, I love the way that, again, now we're just rambling on random things that we like about it. But I mean, like when they shoot at Slimer, the burn marks that are left on the walls after it gets hit. I mean, Venkman has that line, and let's split up. We can do more damage that way, you know?
Yeah. There's so many little things. Like the fact when Slimer's drinking wine and it's just falling through him and spilling onto the table.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I said, we could probably just sit here and literally go beat for beat and go, this is great, this is great, this is great. So I guess that brings us to the remake.
Yeah.
Now, here's and we kind of talked a little bit about this before we started. My initial problem with the remake was the fact that it was a reboot and not a continuation. And the reason that's a problem for me is because – and there are perfectly valid reasons to reboot something, but none of them seem to be in play with this movie. Like, the reasons to reboot something is – the previous series didn't allow for a continuation of any kind, or you want to take it in such a drastically different direction that you need to start from scratch, or, you know, but none of that seems to be the case. You know, they're all talking about how much they want it to be like the old ones. Fine. Okay. So far as I can tell, the rules and the tech effectively haven't changed. So why can't it? And I mean, Ghostbusters 2 already established that supernatural activity can die down to almost nothing. So why can't it be the Ghostbusters have been retired for a while, stuff starts up again, and this new group goes, well, you know, we can build off what that old group did and do something better. I mean, they don't even have to appear. I just don't understand why we're wiping out the old continuity. I'm not going to say I've gotten over that. I haven't, but I've kind of set it aside. I'm like, just swallow that pill. That was my initial problem. My concern now is in the way that they appear to be approaching it. Because I've been holding on to this. Because you have said repeatedly, you know, highest grossing comedy. It's a comedy. Great effects for a comedy, et cetera, et cetera. The thing is, it's always struck me as slightly odd that this movie gets classified as a comedy. And the reason I say that, it's hilarious. Start to finish. It is so funny. But you could strip every single joke out of this movie and it would still be incredibly compelling and interesting and fascinating to watch. And I know that because, like I said, as a kid, I didn't get probably 80% of the jokes, but I still loved it. And more than that, part of the reason that still worked, even though I wasn't getting the jokes, is because when they deliver jokes in the original movie, they just say them as they're going. It never feels like it's set up punchline. It never feels like there should be a rim shot.
And yeah, it's very natural the way that they talk.
And that was, I think, part of the reason why it took me so long to get that some of these were – like, it took me an embarrassingly long time to get the sexual joke at play with Keymaster and Gatekeeper. That took me a long time to pick up on. But the reason is they don't treat it as a joke. So I wasn't watching it as a kid going, there's a joke there and I don't get it yet. I didn't even know they were telling a joke because they don't highlight these gags. The vibe that I get off of the trailers for the reboot is that they approach this as how do we make it funny, and rather than how do we tell this fascinating story about these things and add humor to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because none of the scenes in the original exist only for the sake of telling a joke. They all move the story forward, or they tell us something about the characters. Like, the only thing that I think counts as a throwaway gag is the ghost blowjob thing, but that's part of a montage, so I think they get away with it. But no scene exists only for telling a joke. And a lot of the things that I see in the trailer, I feel like the only reason that what I'm seeing is a thing that exists is so they could set up and enable them to do this joke or this gag. And I just think from a conceptual level, that is completely the wrong angle to come at this property from.
Yeah, I had heard that Paul Feig's original idea was he wanted to tell an origin story. And it's like, well, we've seen that now. I mean, again, you know what? We don't want to get into a whole pre-bashing the thing because they're...
I also want to say that I still plan to see it. And I would love for the new Ghostbusters to surprise me.
Yep.
And to be good and to be fun. And because, like I said, my daughter loves Ghostbusters.
Yep.
I would love to be able to, with a clear conscience, as a semi-movie snob, be able to show her a version of Ghostbusters with all girls that she could love and embrace and enjoy. But I don't have the confidence to feel that I'm going to get that.
Yeah, I'm going into it skeptical, but I am rooting for it, especially since because they've got I think literally the entire cast except for Rick Moranis in this movie. I mean, for all the hate being thrown at this movie, which is just ridiculous. You know, this movie is not going to ruin your child. Nothing except the time machine is going to ruin your childhood. And this movie exists, but I mean, you've literally got Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Sigourney Weaver, Annie Potts, Ernie Hudson, all in this movie. I mean, they are all putting their arms around the new cast saying, go ahead, you'll love it. We are presenting these people to you. So I'm going into it skeptical, but I want it to succeed. I don't want those idiot men's rights people to feel like they've claimed a victory. So I hope the thing's a big success. And, you know, for decades, I've been going to Comic-Cons and seeing people dressed as Ghostbusters. And this was long before the reboot, and it's like people still love it. People want a new Ghostbusters. And, you know, in a lot of ways, of course, we all know this is, you know, everything is done because of properties. You know, I mean, there's money to be made. But people really want new Ghostbusters. And in a certain sense, it's like, well, okay, we can't really put a Ghostbusters 3 together because Bill Murray was always sort of the fly in that particular moment. And now that Harold Ramis is gone, there will never be, you know, that's it. It's over. So, okay, let's start over then. Let's start with a whole new group of people because people just love this concept. And they're, you know, they want a movie to love. And yeah, I'm excited about Kate McKinnon. I think Kate McKinnon is hysterical. And I really hope she becomes like a big star out of this because I think she's really funny. And she looks the most like sort of the three of them. She looks like the most analogous. She seems to be the Egon of the three of them. And so, yeah,
She seems to be the mad scientist version of Egon.
Yeah.
And there are little things that I found in the trailers that I'm grasping onto and hoping that they end up being good. But again, like I said, this one of the strengths I feel of the original is jokeless. It's still a good movie.
It works as a great story about a bunch of people apprehending ghosts in New York City. You
know? Yeah,
it works out perfectly. Yeah, yeah. It's a classic. It's a masterpiece. It's probably a highfalutin word to associate for the movie The Ghostbusters, but it really is a perfect movie. There is nothing you would change. The cast is perfect. The jokes are perfect. It's timeless. It's got a great love story, and it's got one of the great star making turns. It turned Bill Murray from a pretty big star to a global icon, it's just such a perfect movie. And every time they show it over at the big screen, like over the Cinemark chain shows it every year, I go see it because it is just so much fun to watch. And it hasn't aged at all for 30 years, you know. And again, we even get into half the jokes I wanted to talk about. They're just so fun. I mean, for Lord's sake, I see everyone, every 30% didn't even bargain with the guy, you know?
And again, just
stuff.
Tossed off. They just throw out the joke and they keep moving.
the merchandising rights alone are going to make us rich beyond our wildest dreams, which turned out to be true, of course. So,
well, yes.
It's Ghostbusters. It's wonderful. So I think that's going to do it, I think. Do we have anything else we want to talk about with Ghostbusters?
I think we've hit a good point.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for coming on. Where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me all over the internet. If you look for Council of Geeks, you'll find my stuff. There's the Council of Geeks podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, which is also the home to 90s Comics Retrial. There's the Council of Geeks YouTube page, where I haven't gotten to it, but at some point I am going to get around to reviewing, not episode for episode, but an overview, the entirety of the Ghostbusters cartoon. That is in the pipeline, but you know I've got tons of stuff on there. I'm on Twitter @Council of Geeks. Look Council of Geeks on Google. You will find my stuff.
Very cool. I've set a worrying precedent here that if you threaten me, you'll get to do the movie that you want to talk to, but I'll have to take that risk. Again, Nathaniel, thank you for being so passionate and being a fan of the show so early on and wanting to do this. So thanks for coming on, man. I appreciate it. It was a lot of fun talking Ghostbusters.
Hey, if there's a steady paycheck in it, I'll believe anything you say.
As always, if you want to follow the show, you can follow us on Twitter, which is at Film and Water Pod. And, of course, you can leave comments over on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. So, again, Nathaniel, thank you so much. Thanks, everybody. Go see Ghostbusters. Go see the new Ghostbusters. Give it a shot. It's Ghostbusters. You know, everybody, go out and see it. Make it a giant hit. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.
Each sold separately.
Break out the new equipment!
Ghost trap set. Ecto goggles down.
It's Marshmallow Man.
Ecto popper ready.
Neutrino blaster charged.
Roast him.
Got him.
We ain't getting him.
Go!
It's the ghost trap from the real Ghostbusters. New from Kenner.